Accession number 23812, reel 12.
Mr. Doyle, reel 12. We were talking about the sort of layout of the camp. What was round the camp? I mean, was there sort of fencing or barbed wire, or was it not necessary?
No, first of all, it was not necessary to have barbed wire around the camps. Purely and simply because there was no white people in the areas. There was nowhere one could escape because you're thousands of miles from anywhere. If you did try to escape, it would be through jungle territory, of which was pretty like impregnable anyway. We were much too far away. The natives would sell you for a song, and the Japanese would put you to death, for which I will relate a little bit further on as to what actually did happen.
So there was no wire or anything round?
There was no wire. So what there was round the camp, and once again, this is something which I will tell you a little bit later about this memo, because it did happen to be something associated with my life, or saving my life. But round the perimeter of the camps, we put, once again, bamboo uprights. In other words, a sort of a fence around the area. And inside this perimeter of the camp, the Japs would parade. A guard would go around and round the perimeter to ensure that nobody escaped. But that was a pretty slap-happy way, because they knew that we just could not escape and expect to get away with it. So that perhaps, I think it's called a padang. P-A-D-A-N-G, which is a Malay term, I believe, for an open space, or in their kampongs. This would be called a padang, or I think it is, I'm not really sure. But that was, in England, we'd call it a parade ground. And in that parade ground, there would be, we had to build a mound of earth. The mound of earth was used by the Jap commandant because of their way of thinking. They were mostly small in stature, and they always wanted to save face in the best way they can. So if they wanted to make speeches or anything, they stood on the mound, so you had to look up to them and not down to them. That was their funny way of thinking. So that, I suppose, in a nutshell, is the construction of normal prisoner of war camps throughout that railway line, right the way through to the Burma border, of which was called the Three Pagoda Pass. That's just where that finished, and which connected up with the Burmese railway, the other side, in Burma. Well, that's it. So, having constructed this camp, then there were further groups of prisoner of war appeared and took up residence in this particular camp of Tabakan. That was where I first became acquainted with this most wonderful man, Colonel Philip Toosey.
And what were your first opinions of Colonel Toosey?
My first opinions of Colonel Toosey, once again, as best as I can remember, at the initial stages, so here was a man who was, one could tell, was ready at all stages of our prisoner of war life, as it turned out, to stand up to the Japanese as best as he could. Most unfortunately, to the detriment of him in many ways, both by forms of torture, bashings, etc., of which he took truly, like a man, one would say, on our behalf. He tried to do everything he could that was within his power to do what he could for the men, in as much as food was concerned, of cleanliness. This was his most insistent upon cleanliness and discipline, because discipline was most essential in these prisoner of war camps, and the discipline that we had came from such men as Colonel Philip Toosey, because he knew that by exerting discipline, that we ourselves would have respect for one another, and to keep up our morale, and once again to do what we could in some way to show the Japanese that in no way were they our masters, although of course they obviously were, but in no way would we do anything which was detrimental to our country at all. So that was how the prisoner life first started for me. So the next thing that I can relate from that camp, the camp was to be used for the building of the bridge over the River Kwai. And it's not the bridge that one can see nowadays, the first bridge. The first bridge was a wooden construction, and it was quite a hair-raising to build that bridge, because we had to go some distance into the jungle upriver to cut down trees. These we had to do with cross saws, which was very, very hard work indeed. With a Japanese standing over you, ready to flog you if you were to stop for rest or anything. And also axes. I can well imagine that the trees were probably teak, I don't know, but if you hit it with an axe, it simply rebounded back. But eventually you would cut through these trees, and they in turn were dragged down to this fast-flowing river. Whether you could swim or whether you couldn't, you were pushed into the water, and you would cling for your dear life on these trees to be washed down this rapid-flowing river to the destination of the bridge, which was to become the first bridge over the River Kwai. They were then stopped at the site as to where the bridge would be, these trees, and there'd be a continuation of trees from all sides of the River Kwai as men were cutting down these trees, and we did lose some chaps, I can't tell you how many, who drowned whilst doing this particular work. So these trees were brought down, and they were tied to the bank of the site of the bridge. Well, we then had to build into this river types of what one could assume to be little islands of earth. Now, to contain the earth into these little islands, we had to put down stakes, wooden stakes, into this river, and we would do it by hand. They would be rammed down into the bed of the river by hand. And when I say by hand, there was a piece of tree trunk, and on the tree trunk were four handles, and you would stand on a raft, and the stake would be between a hole in the raft, virtually, and the raft was anchored down, and you would have to, four men would have to keep lifting this hammer type of thing in, and you would bash the stakes in. You'd bash them close together, and you would form a square, a larger square. Men on the high banks would then use a tool which was become the tool that all prisoners of war used. It was called a chunkle, and it consisted of a piece of wood, and on the end of the piece of wood was a piece of metal, which would be somewhere at about 12 inches square, I suppose, and that was attached to this handle. And that, men would be up at the top of the bank, and they'd be using this chunkle. They'd swing it from the top of their head down to the ground. That would cut into the ground, and then they would the soil on the metal part would come tumbling down to men at the bottom of the bank. This would be put into a type of raft and conveyed to where I've just described was these square little islands. So you then tip this earth into these little square islands with this fence round, and it became full and full and full till it reached to the top. You see?
Chunkle,
C-H-U-N-K-E-L? I think it would be, it'd be C-H-U-N-K-E-L. I think that's how you would spell it, yes. A chunkle. That was to be the type of the main tool that was used throughout the length of the of that railway, a chunkle. If you ask any prisoner of war what a chunkle is, he will immediately tell you what it is, because it never leaves your mind, those sort of things. The same as your army rifle number or your army number itself. So that was how these little islands were formed. Once the islands were formed, you would then put in these much larger tree trunks, which would be driven through this earth into the bed of the river, and so on and so forth. These little islands would go along from one side of the quarry to the other. And then, once all these trunks were into the riverbed, the Japanese engineers, who were the instigators of overseeing the work done on these bridges, although they were very skillful at what they were doing, nevertheless they had the same mentality as indeed did their counterparts, the Japanese forces. They were fanatical in everything that they did. So we worked on this for, about 6 months or more, I would say, at a guess, until we eventually formed a wooden bridge. And obviously on the bridge, as it was going to be a railway bridge, then railway lines were laid across.
So what shape was the bridge above the island? I'm not sure, quite sure, I didn't quite catch.
What shape was the bridge?
I understand the islands bit. Yeah. You put the islands, but that was sort of like the foundation. How did the bridge look above it? Can you describe it?
Yes.
What sort of design was it?
The design of the bridge was simplicity itself. There were the wooden piles, which I've just described, and then across the top of the wooden piles would be put thick wooden planks. These were put in held in place by the only metal things that I've ever seen the Japanese use. Most of the times it was used, woodwork was used by joints, etc., etc. I don't know too much about the terms relating to joints, such as dovetail joints and that sort of thing, but all I can say is that across these wooden piles were put these flat pieces of very, very thick wood like that. And this would then be filled in with other planks and cross members and that for the rail lines to lay across the top. So that was the type of bridge that was first constructed by the Japanese prisoners of war ourselves over the River Kwai. This was done at terrific speed. There was no slacking or anything.
Did they set you targets to achieve?
Not at that particular point. In other words, they didn't say that you've got to do so many metres or anything each day. We were not told we had got to do that. We simply worked. What you've just referred to comes later.
Now, how did the Japanese guards, or Korean, you mentioned earlier, how did the guards treat you during this early phase, when you were building this wooden bridge?
Always the same. There was no let-up with the guards in as much as they were simply allowed to do whatever they wished to do to us. If they decided to hit you with a rifle butt or a bamboo cane or anything, they choose to do it, they would simply do it. There was no holding back. So we were like the medieval old time slaves in a way. We were the white coolies of the Japanese. And so that continued once again throughout the prisoner of war life, right the way through that railway line where I was, and as history will tell you, existed wherever prisoners of war were under Japanese domination. Exactly the same attitude was taken. That was their manner of going about things.
Did any of them stand out? I mean, we've heard of someone called the Undertaker. I don't, that's just a nickname, obviously, but...
It was commonplace for prisoners of war, and when I say prisoners of war, I mean the British prisoners of war, and the Australians, to nickname people. That seems to be almost a follow-up from wherever in England you go, for example, in Seaside Place, you'll hear of somebody called Brushy or somebody like that. And so therefore we soon nicknamed the various guards, especially the vicious ones, and we gave them apt names. One of them was called the Undertaker. We called him the Undertaker. The reason we called him the Undertaker, because at any moment he'd ensure that somebody would probably be bashed to death. And we even made those nicknames with an element of humour, because that humour was fairly rife throughout the British forces throughout their prisoner of war life.
You don't remember the Undertaker particularly yourself, though? You just remember...
The Undertaker, there was some... one was called Piano Teeth, because he got large teeth. There was one who was as ugly as a frog. We called him the Jungle Princess. There was that sort of thing, you see, of which that's how we actually could inform one another, watch out, the Undertaker is coming, because that denoted a certain person. We couldn't call him Charlie or Jim or give him a name like that. So that's yes.
And they were Korean?
They were Korean, those people, yeah. They were Korean, yeah.
Were they all Korean?
Oh, no. I think, as I've just said, that the engineers were Japanese. They were Japanese engineers. They were dressed very much like the Japanese military personnel, which was not a very slovenly way of dressing, in my opinion. The Japanese army, but yes, we did have that type of person who were our guards, and it was quite a traumatic thing. We soon became adept at trying to avoid him as best as we could. Whilst we were working on these working parties, obviously, especially those who had got dysentery, they had to work as well. All those heavy work and things, there was no quarter given whatsoever. Whether you were sick or whether you wasn't, you just had to knuckle down and work, or get bashed up by these people. If you wanted to go to the toilet for any reason whatsoever, you had to go up to one of the Japanese guards. You had to do, which we had been instructed to do from the onset, right from Singapore, was to bow. You had to bow, first of all, to all guards, irrespective of their rank. That was humiliation in itself, but you either did that or you were knocked unconscious. So you would go up to a guard and you would say the Japanese word, which was benjo, B-E-N-J-O, benjo. And if you just wanted to make water, you would say squashy benjo, squashy meaning small. If you wanted to go the other way, you would say texan benjo, and they would motion to go in just into the perimeter of the jungle, where you could then do your business in there. You were not given an allotted time, so you had to make sure that you came out there reasonably quick. Otherwise, if you didn't, you'd get bashed for being in there too long. That was the type of thing what went on throughout the railway, irrespective of where you were. That was the manner in which work was conducted. Can I then relate now to what happened to the bridge? Yes.
Yeah.
As one knows, we were in a monsoon country. And when the monsoons came, they came with a terrific wind to start with. And the wind would come up. And in the distance, you would see terrific lightning going on, flashes of lightning almost continuous, and as it approached, so would come this terrific rain, and it would come in and flood everywhere. Completely unaccustomed as we were in the first year of being in Thailand, we had no idea what this really meant, but what it really meant, instead of working in terrific heat and the like, of which one could say that you would become blistered up in the heat, but that didn't matter, so we got nothing. Some blokes were lucky enough, especially the Australians, to have that type of Australian bush hat. But if you hadn't, which yourself you had to bear this terrific heat continuously day in and day out throughout your prison war life. And it did a lot of things to us, and as I can say to Peter, who's here, that he can see on my forehead probably where the sun was so hot, and that actually burnt through into your little blood vessels, and caused this sort of patches, the red patches and things. That was the type of thing what prison war was like then. But when this monsoon came, we then had to work throughout the monsoon, irrespective of being drenched, because it meant nothing. The fact whether you were wet or dry, you simply worked. But what was really happening further into Thailand, where the more mountainous regions were, the rain came down these mountains into the rivers, and the rivers become swollen to such an extent they become raising torrents of water cascading down from the mountains and into the rivers, and the rivers would rise at a tremendous rate. And as we had built this bridge, rubbish from the jungles, the trees, the leaves, the whatnot, and all sorts of things were coming down the river. And what happened, which I would have thought that the Japanese would have realised that, but it came up against the bridge, this wooden bridge. And of course it piled up and piled up. It couldn't go over the top of the bridge. So as the weight became more and more, and the tree trunks became more and more, and continued gathering with this terrific torrent of water coming down, so the bridge obviously couldn't stand the weight. And so that first bridge, that's how it got pushed out. So all that work that we'd done on that came to naught. Of which, in a way, we were very pleased, because it was doing no good as far as we were concerned.
Now, what was your personal state around about this time?
My personal state was when I first experienced tropical problems, such as malaria. And so I got malaria. I had no idea what was causing me to be hot and cold at the time. And this was the time, incidentally, when we were jumping into the river and guiding these trees down the river, and I became hot and cold, and then I had this terrific shaking, which is called a Raiga, and there was in our camp a medical officer that particular, I'm talking about the early stages, a Scotsman, I can't just remember his name, a most kind man he was, and I reported to him as to what had happened, what was happening to me, and that sort of thing. And he told me, he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but you've got malaria." But fortunately, it wasn't the cerebral malaria, which is the worst one of all. I think they were called BT and BT plus and that sort of thing. Cerebral malaria. There was various types of malaria, so it wasn't the one which was a fatal malaria. But nevertheless, despite the fact that I've got malaria, I still had to go out and jump into the river and get these down. Despite how ill one felt, it made no difference. So,
any other problems, health problems?
There were obviously, unfortunately, I was one of those who didn't get dysentery, which was a terrible thing unto itself. Once again, perhaps I digress a little bit and go back to the latrines that we built. Now, the latrines inside the camp, when you used the latrines inside the camp and squatted on these bamboos, quite obviously there were feces of dysentery, excretia, all splashed across the top. But nevertheless, this is what you had to stand in to go to the toilet. The toilet soon became full, and it would reach to the top of these bamboos, and it would be a seething mass of maggots. As any prisoner of war will tell you, maggots entered our life in many, many other ways. And so therefore you would squelch on maggots as well as that excretia. So that, as far as hygiene was concerned, toilet-wise, was non-existent. And no wonder that there was so much in the way of disease in camps all the way up that railway line.